Hey, welcome to Long Distance Sisters.
I'm Tori.
I'm McKenna.
And I'm Serena.
Come chat with us while we're far apart.
Okay, let's get started.
Hello.
Hello.
What's happening? Huh?
Hello, welcome to the...
Eighth.
Oh. We were just practicing our ASMR before we turned on the recording.
Now that Tori gave us these microphones for Christmas, I'm very excited. I like ASMR a lot, so this is very exciting.
You can start a whole ASMR TikTok, Serena.
I'll just start a channel because I want it to be a long video.
Okay.
And doctor's appointments aren't short.
The point of view of being at the doctor's office.
Yeah.
It's an odd niche, but.
But that's whenever Tori would practice her physical therapy on me. I was like, yes, I'm just at the doctor's office.
But when
practice on me.
You're alone.
After your seminar, I'm trying to figure out if there's a food group that's bothering me.
Mm.
Was she the one who said that fact, or like that some women who have endometriosis, did I say it right? That since their cramping on their period is so painful, that if they were to get, what's it called? Not osteoporosis, the other one, appendicitis. If they were to get appendicitis, they wouldn't know because the pain is not as bad as that they have on their period. So then they like potentially die from appendicitis.
Yeah. And like heart attacks and stuff. A girl actually died like recently from endometriosis, quote unquote, because an ovary ruptured and doctors kept just not looking into her pain and it ruptured. And so you can get an infection when something ruptures. It's not the rupture that's bad. It's if it's not treated, it gets infected. And go septic and die. Can die.
Oh my God.
So she, like, I don't know if she's the first person, but like she's the first person I've heard of to like officially die like of endometriosis.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Young.
Well, that brings us into kind of what we're talking about today. Tori is a physical therapist specializing in the pelvic floor. She's a doctor. A doctor. We have a doctor in the family. We're so proud.
The first. Mom and dad are
so proud. The first born is a doctor. Will the second and third follow? We don't know.
Do they want to spend more time in school?
I just want to be a doctor because I don't want people to have to call me Miss, Mrs. or Ms. I'm just going to be like, no. Forget that part. It's doctor.
Yeah. I booked flights yesterday and I selected doctor. <My remix. laughs>
That's so cool.
Why not? But then the other airline that I booked with didn't have the option.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I'm a pelvic floor physical therapist. Taking courses, so I'm certified in pelvic floor. I'm not like officially certified, but you don't have to be. That's just like for people who are extra. And then I've also been working on a certification to be a period coach so that I can help women solve hormone imbalances naturally to regulate their period and their cycle. So okay. It kind of is melding that world. I've always kind of been interested in what I felt like was knowledgeable about like sexual health and periods and stuff. When I was trying to learn about my own, I would just kind of stalk forums online and read all of the like crazy shit people believe or think they know about their period. And I'm just like, no, of course, girl, no. Like you did not get pregnant giving a guy a blowjob. I'm sorry. You did not. Oh. Like you should know this. And it baffles me how little people really know about their sexual and reproductive health.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's joining that with my medical interest of kind of opening the minds of people that there's more you can do about a lot of these problems than people realize, whether it's pelvic floor, things like incontinence and constipation, urinary urgency and frequency. A lot of people don't know you can treat those through physical therapy. And then as far as hormone imbalances causing period problems and extra pain around your period, things like PCOS and infertility, that all of these have natural and holistic options to treat them. Mm-hmm. And doctors don't tell you. Doctors just say, take birth control. And that just kind of like band-aids it. But I'm sure we'll talk about that tonight. But yeah.
I have a starting question.
Okay.
So I saw this TikTok and it was like, it had a physical therapist, like specialized in the pelvic floor, like you, and a doctor, and they were arguing about how to treat a patient. And then the patient's just sitting in the middle and is like, what's a pelvic floor? So what is the pelvic floor?
Great question, Serena. Great place to start. And it's true, a lot of people don't know. A lot of doctors and physical therapists don't even know, because in our schooling, we actually skip right over this whole group of muscles. Yeah. In fact, I've read some things about people where their anatomy textbooks have it blacked out, don't even show it. Even I'm talking medical doctors' textbooks. Doctors don't learn these muscles. Like, it's glossed right over. They learn maybe like the basics, but they don't go into it in depth like they do for every other part of the body. Even a lot of gynecologists never are taught this stuff or learn this stuff. They can look into it on their own, but yeah.
Which is weird because like the pap smear is performed by like your physician. My primary care physician is the only person who's ever performed a pap smear on me.
Yeah. But the thing is, when you're looking at a pap smear, like, yes, they're taught how to do that. And they know like, this is the vulva, this is the vagina, etc. But in terms of the pelvic floor muscles and things, they aren't taught because it's not super relevant to that. It's not super relevant to things they're testing and looking for necessarily. However, it is relevant in the fact that we can use it to fix problems like incontinence and constipation and pain with sex, and just the list goes on. And physical therapists, it falls within our field because we are the muscle specialists. We are the movement specialists, the experts on the musculoskeletal system. The only other person that compares to a physical therapist in their knowledge of musculoskeletal, like muscles, bones, joints, ligaments, all that, is an orthopedic doctor. Mm-hmm. And an orthopedic doctor is not going to know about the pelvic floor because it's not a joint. So that's not really their scope. So really, a pelvic floor therapist is the only person who really knows this stuff, like who can tell you the muscles of the pelvic floor and what they do. And
why wouldn't OBGYNs be taught that kind of stuff?
Because all doctors are taught this. They all go through the same med school, and you don't specialize until after, well, like in your residencies and fellowships and whatever you specialize. And it just, it's not super, super relevant, even though it is. You know, they're learning exams and treatments, and they don't treat muscles. So they don't really learn it. And it's led to a lot of just like omission, I think, of education both to providers and patients. Like, there are huge gaps of things that should be common knowledge. Like, we learn them as therapists and we're like, wow, that's so simple and easy. Why isn't that just common word, common knowledge? Like, things like, I saw one today about how for years during labor and delivery for childbirth, they always tell the woman to hold the breath and push. But really, you should be able to breathe with that push if you are properly using your pelvic floor and your core system. But they've always taught it as hold your breath and push because most women don't have that system fully engaged and properly working. So they don't even bother trying to teach them.
Mm-hmm. For me, like when I tumble, I hold my breath just because like I feel like that's what helps me focus the most on what I'm doing.
When we hold our breath, we kind of put our core system into a state of holding. So it's like a hack to engage your core almost automatically is to hold your breath. Because your core engages and it stabilizes. So it's a way to stabilize through pressure. You're using the pressure in your abdomen to like hold that core in place, right? So a lot of people adapt to breath hold with big exertional movements or small ones, but you can actually train not to. But for something like tumbling, I mean, you don't have to really learn how to breathe with that because it's a really quick thing, unless you're having a problem. Like if you're leaking while you tumble, every time you do a back tuck, you pee a little bit, then maybe it's something to work on. But if you don't have a problem with it, it's okay.
So the pelvic floor is the group of muscles.
Yeah. So back to the question. Oh, yeah. Not really sidetracked there. So I have my model. If you're watching the YouTube version, you can see it, but I'll try to describe it. So you have your pelvic bone, right? So it's kind of like a big bowl in the bottom below your abdomen. It's a big bowl and it's made of two halves that are put together, and you have a joint here and you have your spine in the back. That's what connects them. So the muscles that make up the floor of the bowl are your pelvic floor muscles, okay? And they extend all the way to just superficial to the skin of your genitals, basically. And there are actually three layers of muscle that all kind of work on their own, but they typically contract together, all three layers. But there's a lot of muscles that make up each layer, and they all have their own jobs. The superficial muscles, well, all the muscles encapsulate all of the holes and things going on down there. So like your urethra, your vagina, your rectum, all those holes are encompassed by for all three layers. So basically they're all the muscles that control anything in the pelvis. So they control pee, poop, sex, if that makes sense. Sexual function, bladder function, bowel function are all controlled by the pelvic floor muscles. So they can all be regulated by the pelvic floor muscles if you have any problems. Okay. Can I answer your question?
Yes. McKenna, do you have a question?
Well, obviously, if you're having some kind of issue down there, go see a pelvic floor physical therapist. But when should we start to see an OBGYN? Because I've heard like 20 and I'm like, I'm 23 and I've never been. Is that a problem?
Yeah. So yeah, a lot of people say you should have a pap smear by the time you're 21. Okay. So you don't have to do it at an OBGYN. A primary care doctor can do a pap smear as well. But I would say it's good to see an OBGYN for a pap smear. So around the time you're 21, see them for your first time. Or if you are trying to start birth control earlier than that, I would always recommend seeing a OBGYN just to kind of, I don't know, get the best education that you can surrounding the birth control and the options. Or of course, if you're having a problem, see them earlier. But if you're healthy and you're just kind of like looking for next steps or a checkup, I would say 21 for a pap smear. But again, you don't have to do a pap smear at an OBGYN. So you don't really need to see an OBGYN unless you have a reason to. Yeah, because a pap smear is the only really like a routine exam.
Okay.
So you haven't had a pap smear, Serena?
No.
No, I got my first one when I was 22.
No one's ever looked at your hoo-ha?
Uh-uh.
Really?
Uh-huh. Okay, so you mentioned that the pelvic floor also helps control bladder function. And it was at one of the end of one podcast before our like end music. You guys probably heard me say, I gotta pee.
Yeah, there's actually two episodes.
So Tori and Serena already know this. But I mean, when I was little, I had trouble holding in my pee. And now I find myself going to the bathroom a lot more so than my coworkers, at least as far as I can tell. And like, I'm always afraid I'm going to like have a leak at work or something, because I have leaked and stuff, and it's like at home, and it's just like, I'm literally two steps away from the bathroom. I didn't know, like, I only got the urge to pee like 10 seconds ago.
Yeah.
So
what's going
on? What would a pelvic floor physical therapist have me do?
Oh, it'd have you do a lot of things.
Yeah. And this pairs with my question, what are Kegels?
Okay. One thing at a time.
Well, this pairs with my question, like what do you do to treat patients besides Kegels? Because I think that's all we hear about.
Exactly. And honestly, you want the truth? Kegels are usually not the answer. But we'll get there.
Okay.
Another myth that's been perpetuated by society. Okay, so the first question, the bladder. A lot of what we do when we're treating bladder patients is actually more on the education and lifestyle change side rather than direct like therapy treatment. If you have a really bad case where you're like leaking a lot, we might do more hands-on stuff. But a lot of it can be solved just with the power of knowledge, right? And understanding how the bladder works. So in a case where you feel like you have what we call a high urinary frequency, and usually paired with that is a high urgency, right? You always feel like a strong urge to go to the bathroom, right?
Well, not always, but
it like kind of hits you fast.
At least once or twice a day, like I know I have to go right away.
Okay. And does it seem to come out of nowhere?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's probably when you get that leakage, right? It's like not making
It's not every day. That's like maybe once or twice a month.
But like when it happens, it's like when you're rushing to get to the bathroom.
Yeah, like when it hits, like, I got to go right now.
Yeah, because there's different kinds of leakage. So there's the leakage with like an urgency overflow incontinence or like a functional incontinence versus a stress incontinence is like if you jump and you leak because you jumped, but not because you felt like you need to pee.
Oh, it's not that.
Yeah. So yours is with urgency. So how the bladder works is it's trained. It's very easily trained and conditioned, just like a dog. Okay. So when over your life, you maybe always try to go to the bathroom, say when you wake up, before you leave for school, when you're at lunch, when you get home from work, before you go to bed, right? You're training your bladder to tell you, to send you a signal at those times, hey, you probably have to go to the bathroom soon. And so it'll make you feel an urge to go, even if you really don't have to go. Maybe you went an hour ago while you were at the store, you know, but now you're getting home and you always go to the bathroom right when you get home. So it's going to send you a signal to go to the bathroom.
Like when you get in the shower, if you pee in the shower a lot.
Yes.
I'm just saying, it's true.
For a lot of people, they have a strong urgency when they are turning the lock at their door because they always go to the bathroom when they get home. And then they're suddenly rushing and stressed because they're like, oh my God, open, like door open. And that just adds to it. But the good thing is if you can train your bladder into these habits, you can also train it out of these habits. Okay. They say normal to go to the bathroom is about 6 to 8 times. And if you're
I'm not too bad.
Yeah, it's often not as bad as we think, but at the same time, if you don't want to go to the bathroom that much, you don't have to, you know, you can train yourself out down a little bit. You should go at least like 4 times. Don't go less than that. But what happens is you can get that signal to go to the bathroom before your bladder is actually full, right? Because really, we shouldn't get a strong urge until our bladder is like 85% full. But, and that's a lot. Like, that's a lot of fluid in there. You probably rarely ever get that full unless you have that like pain, you know?
Mm.
But if you go more frequently and you always train your bladder is going to forget how much capacity it really has. So instead of telling you you're full at 85%, it'll start telling you you're full at 50%.
Okay.
So on. So you start getting that urge earlier and earlier. And so you have to go more and more. In addition to that conditioning of like a time, you know, or like a situation, like I always have to pee when I go here. When I go to Target, I like to use that bathroom. So I always have to pee at Target. That kind of thing. Okay. I don't know why I said that, but.
It's not.
It's true. A lot of people, you know, pee right when they wake up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so they train their body to have an urge then. And maybe, you know, randomly they got up in the middle of the night, pee at 3 a.m. They don't normally do that. Their bladder is empty at 6 a.m. when their bladder tells them they have to go to the bathroom again. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the other thing. If you're our age, or I would say if you're under 50, you shouldn't have to wake up to go to the bathroom at all.
Maybe. Oh, I do.
Maybe.
I wake up in the middle of the night every night to go to the bathroom.
See, not necessarily normal. Not abnormal, because it's not a bad thing, but you should be able to make it overnight. Unless, you know, randomly it happens just because, you know, maybe you just had a drink a little bit later that night or something. But that's, again, another training thing. If you always wake up at 2 a.m. and have to pee, it's because you conditioned your bladder to wake up at 2 a.m. and tell you you have to pee. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's always going to perpetuate that. Even if, you know, you just went to the bathroom at 12 a.m. Mm-hmm. before you went to sleep. But so you can train your bladder. I usually tell people to start setting goals. So, you know, some of the patients I've worked with go every hour. And so we start with a goal of like, okay, try for 90 minutes, don't go to the bathroom. And then gradually increase that goal to where they want it to be. So that's one method. But for you, you're not going like that close together, it seems. So another thing you can do is you can try to Kegel. So Kegeling actually sends a signal to relax the bladder because you are activating other things like your pelvic floor muscles. And so you can kind of talk the bladder down by distracting it with a signal to relax. And that only works if you really are not full. So if you're at 85%, it's still going to tell you, hey, no, we're at 85% full. You need to pee. But if you're really at 30%, then that can help talk it down and keep it at bay at least for a little while longer. Another thing is sometimes people have to go again really soon after because they don't get everything out, or they feel like there was something left the last time that they couldn't get out. And so sometimes things like rocking on the toilet seat or standing up and down a few times can help get that last bit out before they leave the bathroom and have to come back in 40 minutes mm-hmm. or less than that even.
Yeah, at work it's hard because like sometimes I will go every hour or every other hour at work just because there's so much running water everywhere.
Oh, yeah. And see, there you go. That's a conditioning thing for your brain. Now, it's hard to uncondition that because you're surrounded by it. But for you, I would say trying the Kegeling thing. And then the other thing that gives a lot of people urgency is certain foods that are irritating to the bladder will cause it to have irritation, which feels like that urgency sensation.
That's why I don't drink carbonated beverages on days I have long drives or before we sit down to record a podcast.
Yeah.
Same goes for Capri Sun. I remember that when I was little. That was a real trigger for me, for my bladder.
Yeah. It's a lot of like high sugar content, artificial sugars, carbonation, anything citric or acidic can be triggers and a lot more, but that's the basic list. So Coke, that Diet Coke, even worse.
All right, well, I'll try conditioning during the day, but I'm scared to try to condition at night because I don't want to pee the bed.
Mm-hmm. Well, at I'm night is usually the easier time because you can fall back asleep. Because do you pee right before you go to sleep?
Yes.
And then what time do you usually wake up to pee?
Sometime between 2 and 4, sometimes 2 and 5.
You peed at what, like 10 or 11?
At like midnight.
Midnight, yeah. You're not going to pee the bed.
You can do it, McKenna.
Your bladder could fill for 6 to 8 hours before it will be full.
You can hold it.
And the other thing you can try is not drinking anything 45 minutes before you go to sleep.
Well, it's hard because like I try to drink as much as I can at work, but we're so go, go, go that I like can't. So I like space it out throughout the night up until I go to bed, especially because
part of the problem.
I eat more fiber than the average person. So I have to kind of like drink a little more water to kind of balance with that.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll start chugging right now. Oh god, it's like fish.
It's too much water.
And the other method is just distracting yourself. So maybe when you wake up, put on a YouTube video and fall back asleep, or a song or something that will distract you well, like a song you like to sing along to, or
some doctor role play ASMR.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm doing this, but I kind of like it. Keep going closer to the microphone.
Oh yeah, Serena, way to go.
Yeah, did that answer your question, McKenna? Part one.
Yeah, but like, what are some Kegels exercises?
Okay, so here's the thing about Kegels and why I said they're not always the answer. Kegels are a contraction of the pelvic floor, which is good if your pelvic floor is weak, okay? So most of the people with pelvic floor issues, the issues stem more from tightness rather than weakness.
Mm-hmm.
It could be both. Yeah, it could be either one. But a lot of people, it's tightness more than weakness. And so doing Kegels, contracting a muscle that's already tight, is only going to make the problem worse, right? And most of this is because we have poor coordination of our pelvic floor, okay? So we never really learn to coordinate these muscles and coordinate them to have a full contraction and a full relaxation. We tend to hold them more in a contracted state throughout the day because A, we hold a lot of tension there. B, it's more comfortable. C, maybe we're holding urine and we hold them more contracted. And so we never really learn true coordination. And so we hold them in a shortened position. We have a shortened pelvic floor. But that's also the same reason why things can be weak, is because we're weak and we're lacking coordination to contract the muscles well. So you have a problem with relaxing them, or you have a problem with contracting them. But it all comes back to kind of coordination and nervous system involvement and things that I won't get into. So a Kegel is only for if your muscle is weak, and basically you are contracting the pelvic floor. So some cues that people like to use is like you're squeezing a marble in your vagina, picking up a penny with your vagina, or just the simple lift and elevate, or closing the vagina. And it should involve all of this, right? It's all the pelvic floor. So you're also squeezing your rectum closed, but you want to be careful that you're not including your glutes, okay? So you're not also squeezing your whole butt. You're okay. Just squeezing the rectum, okay? And then once you have the contraction down, you want to work on the coordination piece. So you can pretend you have an elevator in your pelvic floor, right? So pretend your elevator has 5 floors. Take it up to floor 5, that's a full contraction. But then maybe only lower it to floor 3. And then to floor 0, which is full relaxation. And then maybe just to 1. And then maybe to 4. And you can just play around with that.
Oh my God, who's doing it with us?
Everyone, probably. And then the other piece is the endurance. So that is contracting and holding that contraction.
So can men do Kegel exercises?
They can. Men have all the same pelvic floor muscles. They're just distributed a little bit differently because they have a penis. And so they have a few that are different than ours, or a few extra, I guess. And yeah, so they can contract it just like we can. It's exactly the same thing. Cues for men are like, imagine you just got your balls in cold water. So they lift, right? Or if you're stopping urination, like mid-flow, how that would feel. That's not a good thing to do, so don't do that. But stopping urination mid-flow. Men don't have as many cues, but yeah, the cold water one, usually they're all like, oh yeah, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, men can do Kegels too. However, if you have a tight pelvic floor, you want to focus on fully relaxing. Most women don't really know what a fully relaxed pelvic floor feels like. Kind of like you want to sit there and let it relax, and then let it relax more, and then more, because you're probably going to be able to let it relax even more than you think when it's relaxed. You think it's relaxed, right? So first, just working on that and working on combining that with some diaphragmatic breathing, because that can help relax lots of muscles, because it has a cool effect on a nerve called our vagus nerve, which I could talk about all night long. It's the coolest nerve in our body. You can use that nerve and use diaphragmatic breathing to relax all muscles. And so it will help you train that pelvic floor relaxation. And the diaphragm is part of your core system, which the pelvic floor is as well. They're the top and bottom of the box that makes up your core. So if you can get them, you know, your breathing to coordinate with your pelvic floor, you're getting two sides of that whole system coordinating better and working together in a way that usually they don't get a lot of attention to learn how to do. And then beyond that, you can do like actual release to the muscles. So like manual or hands-on therapy using, you know, therapist hands, using tools, both external or internally, even getting at it from the abdomen and the hips. All those muscles are really close to the pelvic floor muscles, so they have a lot in common. If the pelvic floor is tight, you probably have tight low back, tight abdomen, tight hips, etc. And yeah, and then all of that, you learn the coordination one way or the other, whether through the strength side of it or through the relaxation side of it. And then you go into really just training that core system to work together and be more stable. So you're not really training for like, ooh, power, lift, like weight, all of that. You're training for coordination. So it's small, gentle movements that are very coordinated.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then
only a pelvic floor therapist can tell you whether you need the relaxation training or the strength training.
Mm.
OBGYN, never heard of any of this. They're not muscle specialists. They don't learn about how muscles work like this, like a therapist does. We're the only people that learn this. We're the muscle doctors.
So then can you give us examples of like whether they're technical examples or from your personal experience of how you've like treated patients, like what was their issue and like what was your treatment plan?
Yeah, I can try. Okay, so the thing with pelvic floor issues is if you have one, you probably have a lot, because it all kind of comes back to the same root cause, right? Of a weak pelvic floor or a tight pelvic floor or an underlying condition. So a lot of people that I have treated, a lot of women have had endometriosis, or at least had the diagnosis. This is a personal thing, a PT thing, but I don't always trust the diagnosis that the doctors give me or tell patients, okay? Because they could have seen 10 different doctors and got 10 different diagnoses for the same thing, and they write them all down. So I don't trust.
Mm.
I trust what I see. And when I see the results of the testing, yeah, I trust that. But like, I don't trust what the doctor writes on their prescription to me.
Mm-hmm.
Not blindly, at least. If it lines up, I'm like, okay. But anyway. So a lot of women that I treat have endometriosis. And so they have pelvic pain that is maybe constant, maybe cyclical, so it gets worse with their cycle. In fact, with endometriosis, that's almost always the case. So they have also period problems, really severe PMS, cramping, heavy bleeding, things like that. Pain with sex, usually deep pain. When we talk about pain with sex, you can have the more superficial, like external pain, like with initial penetration of something, or in the deeper pain. So like the, oh boy, it feels like it's in really far and it hurts kind of pain, or with thrusting, if we're talking penetration. And that can be anything penetrating you, speculum, tampon, toy, person, anything.
Mm-hmm.
So endometriosis, period problems, pain with sex, chronic pelvic pain. And so this all tells me their pelvic floor is tight. Okay, because they have a lot of pain. So what do you do when you have pain? You tighten up, right? You guard that area. If you hurt your shoulder, you tighten up your traps and your arm and your chest to hold it all guarded. And then that stuff all starts getting tight and achy too, right? So when you have pain going on in your pelvis from anything, you're going to tighten up. So their pelvic floor is almost always tight. Okay, they're holding a lot of tension there and they're holding a lot of trauma there. But I won't get into that either. It could be a whole podcast. And, you know, maybe they've had some surgeries, right? So they have past surgeries that leave adhesions and scar tissue that is dense and adds tightness to that area. And then because their pelvic floor is tight, they have leakage. So we call that stress incontinence, right? When they jump or laugh or cough or sneeze, they leak, or get up from the couch or do a squat, they leak.
Mm.
Because they have this incontinence, they train their bladder to go to the bathroom more often because they think that it will help them avoid leaking. And so then they have a urinary frequency and urgency problem because they're going to the bathroom a lot and they're training their bladder. You know, remember, like we talked about, to think it's full before it's full because they're going to the bathroom so often. So they've got all of it going on. And that's typically the case with a lot of the women I treat, is if you got one thing, you got a whole gamut. Because a lot of it comes back to the same issue of that tight pelvic floor or that poorly coordinated pelvic floor or an underlying condition. And that underlying condition is just the precursor to that root cause of the pelvic floor, right? Mm-hmm. So typically what I do with these women is the first day is mostly education. So whatever I talked about already that is relevant to them, I'll start talking to them about. Usually can't get through it all in one day, but you know, I'll teach them what's the pelvic floor, how does the bladder work, what tight pelvic floor versus weak pelvic floor, coordination, that all that stuff we talk about. And then their first homework with me is just diaphragmatic breathing. I don't want them to think about their pelvic floor yet, okay? We just learn diaphragmatic breathing. Laying down, we give them a low stress environment, so lights off, quiet. And a lot of these women are moms or just very stressed individuals because they have a lot going on, so they're just stressed and trying to balance their life with it. So giving them like 10 minutes to lay in a dark place that's quiet and just focus on breathing and like you're not allowed to do anything else works wonders sometimes. But yeah, we'll just work on that diaphragmatic breathing. And I also do an assessment usually the first day. So I look at their hip mobility, their back mobility, their strength. And then I also can do an internal assessment. So testing the pelvic floor strength internally and just the tissue integrity and feeling for tightness in the muscle, just like I would feel in, you know, your shoulder for tightness in a muscle. I can do that in the pelvic floor. Usually I don't make women do that on the first day unless they're like really gung-ho about wanting to do it. But usually I just tell them about it on the first day so that they're prepared the next day if they want to do it. But it's always up to them. We never have to do it. It just gives me really good information and I can treat more directly. Mm-hmm. But anyone who's not comfortable with it, they definitely don't have to. Once we get the diaphragmatic breathing down, we learn to coordinate the pelvic floor. So we learn about first relaxing the pelvic floor and what relaxation really feels like. And I have them either feel it, watch it with a mirror, whether in the clinic or at home, or I feel it if they aren't sure what they're feeling for, and feel a full relaxation. And then also that contraction. I'm not training the contraction, but I want them to feel that full range of motion, right? So taking all the way through. And then from there, it kind of divides, and it's whether we're working more on the strength and coordination or still that relaxation, right? If I'm going the relaxation route, I bring in a lot of manual therapy. So I also forgot these women often have constipation because they have a tight pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of constricting things. So I do a lot of abdominal massage to help loosen up constipation, any adhesions and tightness in the low abdomen. They say there's a lot that it does even for like organ perfusion and kind of visceral mobilization. Even though that's its own thing, you can learn specifically how to mobilize organs. I haven't learned that, but just massaging the area is going to help circulate and move things that normally don't get moved, mm-hmm. which I always think is a good idea. I might work on their hips and their glutes, and their piriformis muscle is always a big trigger. And it's a teeny tiny little muscle above your glute, but it has a big voice. So we work on that, everything. I do my normal hip strengthening that I might do with someone outside, because a lot of times it all comes back to that poorly coordinated pelvic floor, which means you have a poorly coordinated core system. So we need to start hitting that and working on stability in the pelvis and the low back. And then you treat what you find. That's one of my favorite things about physical therapy. I was really nervous while I was learning things in school because I was like, oh, I have to do this if they have this, and I have to do this if they have this, and it has to be this exact thing. No. Half the time, I don't necessarily know a person's exact diagnosis, but I know they have weak hip flexors and tightness in their back, and you know that all of these things affect each other, right? So I treat those things, and usually that is what helps. Even if I don't know that had they gotten an MRI, it would have showed a herniated disc in their back, I didn't know that. I didn't see an MRI. You know, I didn't get an MRI. The doctor just said they have back pain, right? Mm. You treat what you see. The diagnosis, yeah, it matters, but it doesn't really matter. Pretty much anyone with low back pain, I'm running through the same list of things to check and look at in my head, and they almost always have the same deficits. You know, if it's this thing, or, you know, this category or this category, it's almost always the same. You treat what you see. And yes, knowing exactly what's going on is helpful, but you don't always know that. A lot of times we just get shoulder pain. There's so many things that could happen in your shoulder. Like, so you treat what you see. And yeah, you might have a guess as to what's going on, but it's not that important if we can treat them without a specific diagnosis and it's safe. Mm-hmm. But we're trained to do that.
Do you have any more questions about the pelvic floor, McKenna, or should we move on to periods?
I remember we kind of touched on this one time when we were talking with mom.
Mm-hmm.
But our mom experienced perineal tearing with all of us. Is there a way that a pelvic floor PT could help someone who wants kids or is expecting kids to prevent perineal tearing during childbirth, or at least make it less severe? Because our mom's was pretty bad.
Yes. And based on what I've talked about, what do you think someone who is at risk for perineal tearing probably has going on their pelvic floor?
Tightness.
Yes.
I'm learning.
Less flexibility, less tissue extensibility.
Because I can do the splits, does that decrease my chances of getting tears? Is that what you mean by flexibility?
Not necessarily. Because it's in relation to directly your pelvic floor. You can have a lot of flexibility elsewhere and still have a tight pelvic floor.
Well, I've got flexible hip flexors. I know that.
That's good. However, I would also say I see a lot of hypermobile girls that have pelvic floor problems, because if you have a lot of mobility in one place, that means you have a lot of tightness somewhere else to compensate.
Oh, yeah.
And that somewhere else is often the pelvic floor, if you're in the hip region especially.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I remember, well, one of my friends, she's a dancer. She's a dancer in college. And that was, obviously, she's extremely flexible because she's a dancer. But she has the urinary frequency or urgency to pee, like, all the time. All the time.
A lot of... Because
she has worked those muscles there.
It's extremely it could be, because of her muscle imbalance there. Or incontinence is common with anyone who's in a sport that involves a lot of, like, jumping. And just impact, landing a jump, things like that. Because when you impact, it sends like a really weird force through the pelvic floor, because, you know, like gravity and then Newton's laws, you know, equal and opposite reactions. So your pelvic floor kind of is like, has a lot of load to try and stabilize things while you do have those weird forces growing through it of like jumping and landing jumps, especially people on trampolines a lot. Have a lot of leakage, usually at young ages. Like a lot of teenagers, if they have leakage, it's probably because they're involved in a jumping sport.
Whoa, so my tumbling and my hip flexor flexibility could be contributing to my urinary urgency.
It could, especially if you have a history of it. So yeah, it's hard, you know, it's hard to tell where things started, but yeah. But anyway, back to the question about things you can do to prevent perineal tearing. So most of the things that we talked about in terms of relaxation, so the diaphragmatic breathing, learning what a pelvic floor relaxation feels like, all of that training you can do to prevent perineal tearing. And there's a whole subset of pelvic floor physical therapy that is just dealing with pregnancy and postpartum. And there's a big push for trying to get pelvic floor be standardized part of pre and postnatal care, because it could help so much to A, have a checkup while you're pregnant to educate you about this relaxation stuff and learn it if you need to, learn any coordination you need to prevent things like tearing, just make labor overall easier and help train that core a little bit so that you can prevent like too much of a big diastasis. So that's like the separation of abdominals that happens mm-hmm. to a lot of women, which is unavoidable while you're pregnant, but there are ways you can make it bounce back better after pregnancy, because it does spontaneously heal, but in some women it takes longer or just a little bit more effort. But it all comes back to kind of the same concepts of just learning about the pelvic floor and how it works. Yeah, it's going to just help you with training and being more prepared for a smoother delivery and for what's to come postpartum. And then standardizing a visit with a pelvic floor PT postpartum to make sure everything's healing okay. You're getting back into athletics or sports that you want to get back into. You know, like if you were a runner before, you don't want to be like, well, now I can't run because I'm weak. Mm-hmm. You know, we can kind of make sure you're getting help for that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of women kind of swear by a lot of the education that they get by a pelvic PT in terms of kind of, we call it prehab for labor.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, having a few visits to kind of just get the low down. Also teaching a lot about more optimal positions to deliver in, because laying on your back is really like the least efficient position ever. And yet
oh, yeah, it's
one that all doctors tell you to do.
I heard this. It was like some, I don't know, French king was like, I want to see. So they laid all of his wives or his wife on their back. I was like,
interesting.
What?
In Gilmore Girls, didn't Suki say she was going to do it on her side?
Maybe.
Is that
yeah.
better?
Side is popular if you get an epidural, especially because you lose a lot of feeling in your legs with the epidural. So you can't really like stand or squat or do anything that you need your legs for. But so laying on your side is a good alternative because you can do that. But if you don't have an epidural, you can do anything, like any squatting on all fours, leaning over a bar is a popular one. And it's becoming more and more prevalent. Like a lot more hospitals are equipped for different positions, like having a birthing ball and a bar that can hook over the bed to use however you want, and just having different equipment because birth planning is more popular now. So women like to do this research and learn these things and have a plan for how, what position they want to be in and what they want to do for the birth, more so than 20 years ago, where it was just kind of like everyone did it the same way, except for like some hippy dippy people. Or you can have birthing centers, and there's a lot of birthing centers that are in a hospital that you'll have like a midwife or a doula as part of that, help guide you through and, you know, teach you these things. Be like, oh, well, you seem uncomfortable, let's try this. Or, you know, like having someone with you throughout the labor that is more versed in the different positions and things. Because again, OBGYNs and doctors really aren't taught this stuff. They might learn it on their own because they're interested, but they're just really taught the standard because there's only so much you can cover in medical school, I'm sure. So they can't learn everything. Even yeah. though we think they learn everything, they don't learn everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I recommend any woman who is pregnant to see a PT while they're pregnant, because especially if you want to keep exercising while you're pregnant, it's good to have guidance of a PT because they're really the only people trained in that. Or there's prenatal coach, I guess. It's kind of like a personal trainer who's specially trained for pregnancy, because you can exercise up until the day you go into labor if you want to. It's probably not going to look the same all the way up until then, but still exercise. And you can lift weights and you can do run and whatever you want until you hit the point where it's not comfortable for you to do that. You can keep doing it. Like all that stuff is a myth. Like, oh, you can't lift more than 25 pounds. Total myth. Unless you have a complication going on, that is why you can't do that. But if you are having a normal, healthy pregnancy, you can be out there benching 300 pounds if you comfortable for you. Like,
yeah,
I recommend that. Awesome. You can keep running until you're in your third trimester if it feels good. Most women yeah. doesn't, but
our hospital manager at the Sea Trail Center, who still does like a lot of hands-on work right now because we're short staff, she like everyone's like, oh no, don't lift that heavier thing, and she's like, no, I got it. And she's due in like May, so she's in her second trimester, and she's like, yeah. and she's like, no, I can do it, I can help you guys lift this turtle.
Yeah,
fine.
Especially Like, they don't want you to start doing workouts that you're not used to during your pregnancy. But if you're used to doing, like, reps of, you know, 100-pound deadlifts at the gym, you can keep doing that until you hit the point where you're probably going to feel like you can't do it. And you might have to lower your weight because, you know, your breathing gets harder and, you know, things just feel heavier, more comfortable. Even early on, your breathing gets harder. So you likely won't feel comfortable deadlifting 100 pounds, or, I mean, that's just a random number. Mm-hmm. Like, after a few weeks in, but you could still deadlift 90, then 80, then 70, you know, whatever you're used to. But it's not a time to start lifting 80 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, if you lift 25-pound things at work every single day, there's no reason to stop unless it feels uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And that's a total myth. And obstetricians still, to this day, tell women at their first visit sometimes, oh, don't lift anything over 25 pounds. And that's totally arbitrary. Like, it's just because they're, like, stuck in what the literature said 30 years ago. Because they're, like, an old man OBGYN. Don't listen to your own research, ladies. You can exercise throughout your pregnancy. You can exercise again after, and you don't have to leak. Even a lot of women, like, a lot of the standardization is to not return to exercise until 6 weeks postpartum. Mm-hmm. And a lot of women are starting earlier than that under guidance of, like, a pelvic PT. And the doctor still clears them, knowing they're hitting them off to a pelvic PT, just to, you know, so there's no actual complications going on. Mm-hmm. But because there's a lot of, like, athletes, and they're like, I don't want to wait 6 weeks. Hey, yeah. We're not, like, running a marathon then, but we're doing something. Mm-hmm. And there's some women then that are crazy. You hear stories, and they're, like, competing in a CrossFit, and they're, like, 12 weeks postpartum. And you're like,
whoa, damn. Wow.
So you can do anything with the right training, mm-hmm. but just make sure you find the right training.
Well, should we save periods for next week and do the quiz right now?
Time for our quiz, because we've been talking way too much and I could go on and on. So we're going to save the period part of our chat for next week. So
stay tuned. All things menstrual cycle, birth control. That's the thing that you should also know and pay attention to.
Yes. So excited. All right. Quiz time.
This week's quiz is called, how many of these 13 vagina sex education questions can you correctly answer?
I think Serena and I should try to answer, because Tori probably knows.
Yeah, Tori, don't call it out, okay? Back up. Okay. The word vagina technically refers to blank, the entirety of the female anatomy, the exterior parts of the female anatomy, the canal that connects the uterus to the labia minora, the tube that urine flows out of.
The canal.
Yeah, I think it's the canal.
Yep.
We're correct.
Oh, we're so smart, Serena.
Okay, how should the vagina be cleaned? You should use soap and water inside your vagina. You should use douches regularly. The vagina is self-cleaning and does not require you to clean it. You should rinse it one a day. One a day? Once a day.
Self-cleaning.
Yeah, self-cleaning.
Yes.
We've listened to you, Tori.
I knew that already.
Yes, you.
Sorry that you buy Summer's Eve, McKenna.
What?
She used to.
Forever ago, I bought an unscented one, okay?
Then what's the point of Summer's Eve? Isn't that their whole brand?
I don't know. 70s? To clean the outside.
How long is the average menstrual cycle? 5 days, 14 days, 21 days, 28 days.
Isn't average, 28. Isn't
it 28?
But normal is a wider range. Isn't it like 21 to 35 normal?
Yeah.
True or false? Is it more hygienic to remove pubic hair around the vulva? I think that's false.
I want to say false too.
Yeah. The idea that hair removal is more hygienic isn't based on fact. It is more hygienic not to shave it, although depilation does make pubic lice harmless. Ew. Shave it if you get pubic lice.
Okay. I mean, yeah, the whole reason you have hair is to prevent too much.
Like irritation.
Yeah. Yes. That's why it's there. It's natural.
Yeah.
If you don't want it there, then you have things going wrong in your head. I mean, for your partner.
Yeah.
When men don't want pubic hair.
That's normal.
It's creepy.
Because they don't know any better.
It's creepy when you say you don't like girls with pubic hair. It's weird.
It just means they haven't seen many vaginas.
On average, how much blood does a menstruating person lose during a period?
6 to 8 tablespoons.
I'm going to say that too, because my period cup didn't really collect that much.
Yeah, I think it's...
Yes, correct.
Actually, 50 milliliters.
Wow.
Which doesn't it seem like so much when it's happening?
Yeah. Oh,
well, it doesn't like tissue come out too?
Yeah. A little
but bit. Like, you know, when you like feel like a leak and you're like, oh, that was a big yeah. one, but it was like a drop.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're so over dramatic.
And technically, unless you have a heavy flow, your period cup should be able to catch your entire period. You shouldn't leave it in your whole period. So you shouldn't test that. But because a period cup is about 50 mils.
Mm,
that's all that you're losing.
That's crazy.
It feels so drastic. It
feels so much worse. Overreacting. What is the function of the fallopian tube? Eggs. Transport the ova, egg, from the ovaries to the uterus.
I mean, do we even have to read the others?
That's okay, the answer. Let me read the others. Allows for proper urinary functions, acts as a natural filter for toxins in the bloodstream, increases estrogen during time of menstruation. Yeah, it's the egg one.
Yeah, ovaries to uterus. And true, the fallopian too.
True or false? Disney produced a short film called The Story of Menstruation in 1946. Oh, Lord, I hope it's false.
I'm going to say false.
I feel like it's true because it's like, that's so detailed.
I know they did like military ones and like they're like, I've heard of so many shorts, but maybe like YouTube channels just don't want to mention menstruation. So they never talk about it as a fun fact.
I'm going to say true, but I'm scared. No, it's true.
In collaboration with Kotex.
Here's YouTuber Mama Dr. Jones. I think she reacted to it.
Oh, no.
She's a gynecologist.
You could react to it on your YouTube channel, too.
Okay. What does PMS stand for? Premenstrual soreness, postmenstrual syndrome, premenstrual syndrome, postmortem syndrome. Is that like death?
Premenstrual syndrome.
Yeah.
Oh.
For the longest time, I got pre and post confused. I didn't know which it was.
What did Serena think it was?
That one. Sure. The shape of the clitoris resembles blank. A button, a rod, a bean, a wishbone. Isn't it a rod? Isn't it like
it's long? A wishbone. It's a wishbone. Because it like goes... the part that like where the end sticks out goes up, but then it goes like it curves again.
Oh, interesting. Oh, this just shows a picture of vaginas. That doesn't help me.
A clitoris is like an iceberg. You only see the very tip.
90% is still underwater. All right, true or false? Ovaries contain 1 to 2 million eggs at birth.
I know we have our eggs at birth, but 1 to 2 million seems a lot.
I don't think that's enough.
I think it's too much.
I think it's more. I'm going to put false. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. I just like, it's how? True.
It's well, true.
Okay.
How many do we lose per period?
So one. This one, I don't buy it's totally true. So there's a lot of research. It's only a theory. It's a there's theories between do we have all of our eggs when we're born and they're just dormant until we start hitting puberty, or do we develop them cycle by cycle? Oh. Or at least closer, you know, maybe not every cycle, but like, you know, a few months out, you're starting to make one for a cycle down the road or something.
There are fish that make it throughout their life.
Yeah, because they say there's no evolutionary purpose to why we would have them and hold them dormant.
Yeah.
So.
I feel like that would just make them worse over time.
Yeah, they're overcooking. Did you? So I took intro to philosophy in the fall, and our professor was telling us something Aristotle said. I didn't realize he was such a sexist prick and probably racist, but Aristotle, like, because his dad, I think, was a doctor or a surgeon or something. So he like saw bodies of, you know, males and females. Mm-hmm. And he said, females are just underbaked males to where their reproductive system hasn't come out of their body. So they haven't been cooked in.
What?
That is what I was like, cool, do. What?
I feel like you're at such an evolutionary disadvantage if you have your reproductive parts outside of your body. Because then they're not protected. So it's like, wouldn't they be underbaked?
Right.
They got soggy bottoms.
I actually like read this book and she was talking about how we actually, men and women, don't have different parts. Mm-hmm. Like every part in a man has the corresponding part in a woman. Mm. And it just maybe developed slightly differently because of the need for it. But we all have like everything coordinates to something in the opposite gender.
Like the hot dog and the wishbone, aka the penis and the clitoris.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting. Like we have like the same ejaculatory duct. We just use it differently. We store eggs and things and they store semen, but they're like in like the same things. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Two sacks.
Like there's not a different part in either.
McKenna, what size wishbone you rocking?
I am not. What kind of question is that? How am I supposed to know? I only see the tip.
Okay, well,
so I don't even see it.
Know what they say about the size of the tip?
I don't know what they say. It's
just a joke for Kevin. Okay.
Okay.
How many eggs through ovulation are released during someone's lifetime?
300 to 400.
I'm going to say thousands. Why not?
I'm
going
to say 300 to 400. Yeah.
I'm smart.
You only release a couple of each cycle, like one or two.
I hope this person cited their sources.
Probably not.
Probably not. It's BuzzFeed. Okay. True or false? A woman set the Guinness World Record for childbirth after her 69th kid.
False. Who? They chose the number 69, guys.
That's why it set a record, baby.
That's why she wanted to set that record.
Oh, I hope
it's false.
Oh,
no.
Just press it. Oh, my God.
True. Oh, no. And a peasant, a Russian peasant. How was she affording that?
A lot of them probably died.
Yeah, a lot of them probably died. She
in the 18th century.
Like some sort of like welfare stipend for each kid. So maybe that was her way of making money.
No way.
Four sets of quadruplets.
Russia in the 18th century. No way. Okay. She gave birth 27 times, having 16 sets of twins, 7 sets of triplets, and 4 sets of quadruplets.
That is crazy. You know how rare that is?
Wow. All right.
So the chance.
No single kids. No singular kids.
The chance of having identical twins naturally is like 0.5 or something. Or 0.05. Like,
well, it doesn't say identical twins.
Yeah, but still. Quadruplets?
Yes.
4 times?
But also
no single children. No, like I don't share my birthday with a single sibling. No one.
I don't know. It's no K+8. You know what I'm saying? Those sextuplets, right?
Right.
It's sextuplets, yeah. And then twins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The period starts when which hormone is dropped? I'm going to say, I have to read them out. Testosterone, progesterone, estrogen, serotonin. Progesterone sounds right because pro is like, maybe that's it. But it sounds pre.
I feel like progesterone is the one in birth control. And nor Or what does my birth control say?
I say progesterone.
Because like you start your placebo and then your period starts. Incorrect. So like technically that
is progesterone, McKenna.
Oh, okay. Norgestamate and ethinyl estradiol tablet. I don't know what
the Zuntide.
Okay. That's the quiz. We passed.
Scored better than 93%. And we got two questions wrong.
Yeah. Wow. Which is crazy because I don't think I know it's me, but it wasn't that hard. And people still don't know the basics.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sad thing. And it's not their fault. It's terrible sex education and stigma and
Whoa. Two dudes made this quiz. What? I'm looking them up. Well, they don't have their pronouns, but it's Christopher and Andrew. Guys, what do you think you're doing? All right.
Maybe it was meant to be like for guys to take.
Guys can take it.
Yeah. Guys should know this stuff too, so they know it's normal. Further do we hear down there.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Andrew. Okay, well, that's it. Bye.
All right. Come back next week to hear all about period problems.
And birth control.
Birth control. Yes. Love that topic.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's Long Distance Sisters. Be sure to subscribe for more episodes and leave a good review.
And check out the video version on our YouTube channel.
You can find all of our other social media information in the description.
Talk to you later.
Bye.